From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
The March 29 budget, the launchpad for the election, is fast approaching. For the government, it is the opportunity to get the political conversation squarely onto the economy and to offer some enticements for voters. But with the rising cost of living and a lot of discontent over soaring petrol prices, it is not turning out an easy budget to frame. To talk about the economic outlook and the budget, we have Chris Richardson from Deloitte Access Economics, who's just finishing his pre-budget monitor. Chris Richardson, can you firstly describe the economic environment in which this budget's being put together?
It is rather better than the government expected it to be when Treasury put together the last update, the MyEFO that was released just ahead of Christmas. Three things. First, the recovery from COVID has been faster and larger than Treasury had expected. Second, commodity prices, the price of the stuff that Australia sells to the world, everything from iron ore to coal to gas to wheat, they've boomed, whereas Treasury had been expecting a bit of a bust. And the last thing is that inflation and wage growth have picked up. Now, you might think that higher inflation is a bad thing, and it is, but it's a good thing for budgets.
In this environment, then, should the government be withdrawing support and so reducing the budget deficit, or should it be pumping more money into the economy?
It definitely should not be pumping more money into the economy. It should be withdrawing support, though perhaps the next piece on the chessboard, if you like, around withdrawal of support should come from the Reserve Bank. So because things have changed so fast, it's worth stepping back for a moment. Unemployment in Australia in coming months may well drop to the lowest that we've seen in half a century. The economy is strong for all its challenges, for everything that's happening. There is remarkable strength out there in the Australian economy. So it no longer needs the emergency supports it's been getting from government and from the Reserve Bank. And indeed, they're starting to be withdrawn. Government spending is already down 10% in the last year alone. That's simply some of the COVID emergency measures dropping out. And the Reserve Bank has changed already. It hasn't raised interest rates, but it stopped protecting longer-term interest rates. So, for example, if you've got a 1, 2, or 3 year fixed mortgage, that's much more expensive today than it was a handful of months ago.
One of the things that the public are concerned about is the price of petrol. It's jumped by a third in just the past 2 months. And there's a lot of talk about excise. Should the government be doing something on excise, or would that be both ineffective and bad policy? And if you think it is bad policy, is there anything else the government can do on this petrol front?
It is bad policy. So let me step back and explain. The government raises excise on every litre of petrol sold. That's currently 44 cents a litre. And given that many people are paying $2.20 a litre at the moment, that's one-fifth, if you like, out of the overall price of petrol that you're paying at the moment. Is that government excise? And it is fascinating that here we are, it's 2022, and one of the greatest political questions in the country is, what can our politicians do to make a fossil fuel cheaper? Having said that, petrol is always political, and the pressures there are very much pressures being felt in suburban Australia. Over the last year, we've had price pressures, not just in fuel, we've had it in food, we've had it in health and in housing. But now that it's really, really notably in fuel, that hurts the suburbs, and the suburbs, of course, where the swinging voters are, and it's an extremely central political question. But at 44 cents a litre, it's just not a big enough lever. You can't fix the impact on petrol prices of a war in Europe by using a band-aid on a tax here in Australia. It's just not big enough, and even if you try it, those sorts of band-aids, they go on easily, but they hurt politically to rip them off again. So basically 20 years ago, John Howard did something similar. The politics of petrol was getting tricky. He promised simply to freeze the amount of excise paid, which ordinarily would go up with inflation. it took the better part of a decade and a half for that freeze to come back off again. And you know, yes, I think it's a bad policy. You also ask, is there anything else it can do on the petrol front? It can stay calm. Lots of the headlines of the moment.
Weeks out from an election, stay calm.
I can only wish, Michelle. The today's oil price internationally implies that petrol prices in Australia in less than a fortnight from now will be somewhere between 15 and 20 cents lower a litre. I'll say it again, petrol prices are headed down. So they peaked about 10 days ago. They've come down since. They're still coming down at the moment as markets start to worry about the impact of COVID in China. It takes a bit of time, takes a fortnight really, for that to show up in petrol prices in Australia. And of course, there's no guarantee that it doesn't go back up again. But you're already likely to get a bigger impact on prices than anything the government would do by just waiting 2 weeks.
Now, another matter of speculation has been the low and middle income tax offset. This is worth about nearly $8 billion a year, and it was meant to be temporary while other tax cuts came in, but the government has already extended it, and it seems under pressure to do so again, because otherwise it'll be accused of putting up taxes. What do you think it can do? What do you think it should do? And what do you think it will do?
I don't think it should roll that over again. To be clear, if you're getting that tax cut, the low and middle income tax offset, otherwise known to the nerds as the Lamington, if you're getting the Lamington, you're having your Lamington and you're eating it too, because it's that initial tax cut, the Lamington appeared basically 5 years ago now. 4 years ago now, and then it got doubled up. If you're getting the Lamington now, you're getting two tax cuts, the stage one and stage two of the tax cuts. That was never the intention, but it got doubled up because the economy was in trouble during COVID and the government was desperate to get money in the hands of families in the hope that they would spend it. And so it kept it going longer, even when that tax cut got doubled up. The name of it, low and middle income tax offset, you might therefore think it goes to those on low and middle incomes, but it doesn't. It goes to taxpayers, personal taxpayers, on low and middle incomes. And for entirely good reasons, almost half adult Australians don't pay personal tax. They're unemployed, they're retired, they're taking care of the kids, you know, they're in a job, but they earn a very low income from it, they're disabled, whatever it may be. A whole bunch of people who have indeed low incomes. And if you're paying tax, then you're almost automatically in the top half of income earners in Australia. And that tax offset does indeed, you know, go to taxpayers. Great analysis out of the ANU Centre for Social Research and Methods. It shows exactly what shows, you know, our results show too, basically. It's higher income families who get that money. It's middle class welfare. It would be bad policy to keep it going. And it is a bit of a pea and thimble trick as well. When the economy needed help, and it, you know, 2 years ago, almost exactly, the economy was in desperate need of help. The unemployment queues were leaping and the rest. And the things that got done then, you know, JobKeeper or indeed, for that matter, the doubling up of the tax cut that we're talking about. That was good policy, right? That fought to keep Australian families and Australian businesses going in a time of trouble. We are at a very different moment now. Again, the unemployment rate would say we're about to have the strongest economy we've seen in 50 years. And in that economy, if you throw extra money at it, if you artificially lower petrol prices, if you keep this low and middle income tax offset going, whatever you do, it has impacts in the economy. You, other things equal, you push up inflation, prices go higher, so everybody loses a bit of purchasing power. And as those prices go higher, that spooks the Reserve Bank, so probably brings the Reserve Bank off the bench a little earlier, and it raises rates a little higher. And the other thing, you know, again, if governments are throwing extra money at the economy, some of it will go on imports. And so Australian tax dollars will be strengthening other economies around the world rather than Australia. It's a different equation in a strong economy than a weak one. Now, suddenly, the Australian economy is strong.
So what do you think the government will do given its political situation?
And that's the difference between the thing I'm talking about, which is hopefully good policy, and good politics. It's not unusual for those two things to be in competition with each other. Immediately ahead of an election, that's exactly the moment when you tend to get policy perhaps not at its finest. In fact, if you look back over time, if you think of moments in Australian history when the government of the day was facing an election and was way behind in the polls, that's when some of our big mistakes got made. Think back to 2007, there was a coalition government. It was worried it was going to lose in the polls, so it promised very, very large personal tax cuts. Or think of 2013, a Labor government. Again, it was behind in the polls, and it promised a whole lot of new spending. And the underlying political calculus is pretty clear. These generous promises might get us re-elected, and we could worry about paying for them afterwards. But if the other lot win, then, it's their problem. They'll have to do the hard yards. Now, we have a bit of that risk right now. To be fair, I don't think the government will come out swinging with big promises the way the coalition government did in 2007 or the Labor government did in 2013. But all these conversations, another year of Lamington, lower petrol prices, lower beer prices, bringing forward the third stage of income tax cuts, all these sorts of things talk to me much more about the politics than they do about good policy.
One issue that Labor has been pushing for a while is flat wages growth. Wages growth is about 2.3% annually, and it remains low. It's well behind prices growth, which is about 3.5% now. Is there anything the government can do on the wages front?
Not a lot, no. So a couple of things to note. First, it's definitely going to get worse before it gets better. Things like petrol prices, as we talked about, they're pretty high. They haven't, the latest burst in them hasn't really shown up in the inflation figures yet. Food prices. So between them, Russia and Ukraine sell fuel and food to the world. And what's happening there with Russia's invasion of Ukraine means basically food and fuel prices are going up. And the food side of it, it's great for Australian farmers, but everything down to bread, you're hearing about all sorts of tinned food going up in price. Our estimate would be that when the election is being held, presumably in the month of May, prices will be about 5% higher than they'd been a year earlier. And ignoring the GST, when we kind of deliberately raised prices as that was introduced, that's the fastest inflation Australia's seen in a quarter of a century. And it is travelling faster than wage growth, substantially faster than wage growth. And almost every election is a cost of living election, and almost every election shouldn't be. This one is genuinely a cost of living election. There is real pressure on family budgets. But worth noting a couple of things. One, Australian families have a pretty big buffer. They've just had a couple of years in which government support was very generous, and the ability to spend money was much less than usual. So Australian families have saved $270 billion more than they usually would over the last couple of years. And I know that's just a big number, but it actually is a lot. That gives us a much bigger buffer to, most of these things like high petrol prices and so on, I'm hoping are pretty temporary. Second thought, all of this stuff, whether we're talking about wage growth or, petrol prices or tax cuts and the rest of it, the underlying assumption is that there is some magic wand. Well, the government should do something about it. And governments, and for that matter, particularly oppositions as elections come around, are pretty guilty of implying that they can do stuff. So the bad news I would have for people is that by and large, governments don't have a magic wand. They can't necessarily easily solve things. And for that matter, if they did have it, they'd have done it long since by now. Is there anything the government can do? Well, there is, but it would take years to have an impact and you wouldn't like it. You could have a more, a stronger Australian economy through all sorts of reforms. We could have a better tax system. We could have a better competition policy. We could run our cities better. We could have a much better separation of who does what between state and federal governments. And if I actually got into the detail of that reform wish list, you would hate me. you would, you know, because I would be suggesting a bunch of things that people would truly hate, but they would eventually give us a stronger economy, and that would bring stronger wage growth. But a magic wand, and you know, if any politician is talking about, you know, how terrible wage growth is through the election campaign, please give them the Grace Tame side eye, basically, because there's not much that any politician can do about it. They're grandstanding.
And I don't think the politicians are in any mood for those more sweeping reforms anytime soon, are they?
No, look, you know, partly we've tried to protect Australians from all sorts of things. You look at COVID, we've been stunningly successful. You know, we tend to forget for all the challenges. And, you know, once again, COVID case numbers are picking up now. On an international scale, Australia has handled the COVID crisis supremely well. Our economy, remarkably strong. Our health outcomes are remarkably better than most nations. And I take you back to the global financial crisis, 2008, 2009. And at the time, Australia handled that really well, too. We handled the current one under a federal coalition government and that previous crisis under a federal Labor government. It turns out Australia is pretty good at crisis management. And the world, I think, in many ways recognises that. We do a bunch of things well, but there are definite limits on what we can achieve. And economic reform has been losing votes for a long time, and neither side of politics has much appetite.
One bright spot is the economic forecast for unemployment. This has been coming down, and the Reserve Bank now says it will fall below 4% by the end of the year. How low do you think it might go, and what's driving that?
On our forecast, we're just a handful of months away from a 3.5% unemployment rate. Again, basically the lowest in half a century. A few things are driving it. But the standout thing is something I just mentioned. We actually got our economic policies right during COVID. Not perfect, I should say. They were, you know, like everybody else's policies, they weren't perfect. But they were substantially better than the average. And it meant that as and when state economies opened up, the Australian economy has absolutely roared back. And that's been very impressive to see. In nerd speak, it's called fiscal multipliers at the zero lower bound. It basically means if governments step in and spend money, you know, think of things like JobKeeper, at a time when a central bank like the Reserve Bank has interest rates as low as they can get them, you get a magnificent impact. And what we've had is a magnificent impact. In particular, you know, that's been helped along, and not the main thing, but it has been helped by the fact that borders were closed. We needed workers. They couldn't come in.
So with the borders now opening, as Australia takes in migrants and students and temporary workers, will that slow or reverse the fall in unemployment?
One of those yes and no answers. Let me take you to the long-term thing first. Over the longer term, migrants do not have an impact on unemployment. Now, that's not what most people think. They think, oh, you know, migrant there got that job and, you know, I didn't get it, or my friend didn't get it, or such and such, you know, so-and-so in my family didn't get it. Surely that's having an impact on unemployment. And that forgets the basic economics. If somebody, if a new migrant puts up their hand to take a job, gets that job, they earn an income and they spend that money, and it creates the next job. So sure, migrants are taking jobs, but they're also creating jobs. And over time, it does affect the unemployment rate. And if it did affect the unemployment rate, then you would fear, as the unions famously did in the late 1970s in Australia, that, you know, a group of people who were joining job markets at the time and grabbing all the jobs would lead to permanently high unemployment in Australia. That group was married women. Why didn't we get permanently high unemployment when married women joined the workforce? Because they earned money, they spent money, and that created extra jobs. And again, if you thought that, oh no, you know, somebody taking a job stole that job from somebody else, then of course you would never have any children, because the little buggers would grow up and they would steal all the jobs. So the big point is that closed open borders, right? You know, migrants don't steal jobs. Migrants don't have long-term impacts on unemployment, but they do have a short-term impact. Basically, in a nation like Australia that gets a lot of migrants, or typically gets a lot of migrants, that means, you know, it takes them time to get a job, to settle in, you know, to make sure it's the right job and they don't change it in the short term and the rest of it. Other things equal, high migration nations tend to have slightly higher unemployment than low migration nations. Nothing really to do with the migration, just the fact that there are more new workers finding their place, as it were. And so when we closed the borders, that element disappeared and it helped unemployment go down. As we open the borders, it'll work the other way and it'll slow unemployment going down. But it's, you know, too many people are running around saying closed borders is a magnificent thing for unemployment. That's wrong.
We've obviously run up a lot of debt in dealing with the COVID crisis, and that's for very good reasons. And our debt level is still low compared to many other countries, but it must be starting to cost a bit in terms of servicing it. Is it becoming a worry?
First point is I'd prefer that we didn't run up the debt, but that's the same thing as saying I'd prefer that COVID had never existed, or COVID did come. We had to run up that debt. Second thought is the point is not debt. The point is the cost of debt. And I suspect most people listening would be surprised to know that the interest costs of the federal government as a share of national income are lower today than they were before COVID hit. Lower today and lower across all the years the government is forecasting than they were in 2018-19. Because debt has gone up and interest rates have gone down, and interest rates going down has been the bigger of those two things, partly because we get those lower interest rates on old debt as it comes due to be refinanced. So sure, worry about the debt, but worry in particular about the cost of debt, the combination of debt and interest rates. And so far, that has absolutely not been scary, certainly nowhere near as scary as the public debate has it.
But it might become more as time goes on.
Absolutely. And interest rates are at record lows in Australia, and they will go up. I would note, though, that as interest rates go up, as that becomes a rising cost to the budget, they'll be going up not for the hell of it. They'll be going up for a reason. They'll be going up because inflation's going up, and inflation will be going up because wage growth is going up. And that combination is actually good for budgets. Reflation, as it's called. Basically, you know, all those things are getting stronger: wage growth, price growth, and interest rates. And the three go together. And it is a mistake to only pick one of them and say, well, what about the impact of that? You've got to look at all three. And if interest rates rising is bad news for the budget, remember, they'll be rising because wage growth and inflation are on the rise too, and that's good for the budget.
Well, on interest rates, when do you think we'll see the first rise, and how fast will they go up?
Look, I would say end of 2022, perhaps even early 2023. The key, you have to watch wage growth. Ultimately, you know, the things driving inflation at the moment are mostly temporary. It's petrol, it's shipping costs, it's all sorts of things. Ongoing, two-thirds of inflation for consumers is driven by wage growth. If we don't get wage growth, we won't get sustained inflation. And it's sustained inflation the Reserve Bank has to worry about. So it will keep a close eye on wage growth. Wage growth may pick up fast enough to see that first interest rate rise at the end of this year. It may pick up more slowly, in which case interest rates won't go up until early next year.
Now, over the years, you've very often made the point about how much Australia's prosperity has been tied to China. In the light of everything that's happened internationally and in our bilateral relations with China, how much of a knock will all that be to our medium-term prosperity in this country?
It will be a knock. You know, ignore all the politics for a moment and just look at the economies. Basically, you know, as economies, Australia and China are friends with benefits. We have what they want. They have what we want. You know, we have resources. They have manufactured goods. And that's worked really well for both of us. We have brilliant universities, and often, you know, their students come here. We've got, you know, great beaches and other things, and often the tourists come here as well. It's worked great, but the geopolitics has become tricky, increasingly tricky. And in particular, you know, China's enormous rise and the demand that's driven for things like iron ore. It's not just the geopolitics that's changing. It's the economics that's changing well, and Australia's got to change with it.
Now, just finally, has the world now turned its back on globalisation?
I hope not, because, you know, one of the oldest discoveries in the field of economics was that everybody should do what they do best. I'm good at this, you're good at that. Well, all right, I'll concentrate on what I'm good at, you concentrate on what you're good at. And then we'll just swap with each other. That's what trade is. Ultimately, that's what globalization is. And so I'm seeing the geopolitical troubles of the moment as quite bad news around globalization. Having said that, globalization occurred because we're all better off. You know, we are better off doing what we're good at and swapping with each other. So even if the politics is pulling in the other direction, that basic economic argument in favor of globalization remains very strong. I would say the jury is out. You know, sure, there's a pause in globalization. We may even go backwards, but I'd still be pretty hopeful we don't go back far.
But it's interesting, isn't it, that the conversation or the advocacy of globalization has changed so quickly, transformed by COVID and transformed by a changing strategic situation. Now it's all about self-sufficiency to the greatest degree feasible.
Sure. There is a clearer argument than there ever was around self-sufficiency in manufacturing some things in the health field. Vaccines is a good example. It's true around defense manufacturing and supply lines. It's not true around everything and that vast everything else, if you like, outside of health and defense. I think there's still a pretty good case there for us to each concentrate on what we do best.
And self-sufficiency really is protection by another name, isn't it? And protection, it seemed like yesterday, was a dirty word.
Yes. North Korea. Look at a nation that doesn't trade much and you see the impact on its economy. Trade has stunning benefits and we turn our back on it at high cost. Again, it's why I'm hopeful we won't turn our back too far. And by the way, it's not just the movement of stuff, of things across borders. Movement of people across borders helps that movement of ideas. It helps also, I would say, us to recognize that people elsewhere in the world aren't so evil and that they're rather more like us than, you know, perhaps we initially give credit for. I'd hate to see us turn our back on many of those things.
Chris Richardson, thank you so much for talking with us today. And that's all for our Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Ellen Duffy. We'll be back again soon, but goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevier. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.